Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast with me, Das Christodoulou. Junkie, DJ, punk, pill popper, petty criminal, binge drinker, screenwriter and TV repairman, Irvin Welsh has lived more lives than the average literary novelist and survived to tell the tale. One of the most provocative and iconoclastic authors the British Isles have ever produced, Welsh is of course best known for Trainspotting and its sequels, alongside an array of equally brilliant fiction. His latest is the crime thriller The Long Knives. He joined Esme Bright for a freewheeling journey into his febrile imagination. Enjoy.
So I want to know, because you're currently filming the new television show of your new book, as well as promoting the book at the same time. So you're very much in the world of D.I. Ray Lennox. But was the sequel to Crime planned initially from the beginning?
No, not at all. And yeah, I don't really think it is a crime novel as such. Like, I think it's more of an existential thriller. I'm not really interested in kind of crime fiction in, you know, in this traditional sense of it. But Dougray came to me after, Dougray Scott, who's the lead actor in it, came to me after he'd read Crime and he goes, I've got to play this character. I just want to play Ray Lennox. So I need to play him. Like, yeah. So we tried to get a film done of it. And we'd had a, you know, we'd done Filth, John Baird had done Filth, and John was quite interested in carrying on with Jamie Bell as Lennox in Crime, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd met Dougray by this time, and I thought, well, you know, it was like, I just kind of felt that he had such passion for it. You know, he just, it's like when you saw James McAvoy kind of in Filth, and you saw like kind of Robert Carlyle playing Begbie and all that, and he's reprising Begbie. They're kind of passion projects, and an actor gets really right into them, and you just have to let them go with them, like, you know. And so Dougray and I, we tried to get made into a film first, and, and then we realised that there was so much to Lennox, it would be, and so much to the book, it would be better as a sort of a kind of long-form TV drama. And since then, you had the rise of that kind of genre. You know, you've had all the HBO stuff, and you've had this, you know, it's unacceptable, and it's kind of seen as the new novel is in the long form TV show now. So we went to that approach, and it took us a while to find the right producer. We had a lot of setbacks on the way, but you just keep on, and it took us a good 10 years really to get to where we've got to with it. But we stuck it out. And it's been great. You know, we've got Buccaneer Media have been our partners, and we've kind of moved from BritBox to ITVX, but it's the same ITV-led thing with Polly Hill, and they've been fantastic. You know, they've been into that place now that they want to, you know, the ITV is kind of wants to, like all other kind of platforms, wants to move from having an older kind of terrestrial TV audience into a sort of, into the whole, the more uncertain but kind of rewarding world of streaming and all that, and you know, the global world of it. So that's what we've been doing, basically. We've been trying to do a story that's you know, that kind of gets the police procedural element to kind of hook the more traditional kind of sort of audience in, but then move it to where we want it to be, which is like the existential thriller, so kind of character-based stuff, not so plotty, more about the character and how they relate to the world and how they see the world. So moving it from, like, basically, you know, what I see crime as being is kind of starting off in the Bill and ending up in True Detective. A book is different. A book, you can just go nuts. You can just completely indulge yourself and get right into the character's head, make it all about the character. So it's a very different animal as a book as it is a TV show.
Yeah, you do crack a joke about Taggart in the book as well, which I enjoyed. But it's sort of, you're right in saying that it's not quite within the like traditional Scottish crime canon as well, because the characters and the police officers aren't your typical clean-cut figures. And while, you know, you've changed genres quite a lot throughout your career, but it does have all your usual ingredients for your typical, you know, gritty storyline, you know, themes of addiction. You've got Scots language, gallows humour, and it's also very political as well. And I wanted to talk to you about that because it's one of the main things in this new book, as well as the trans storyline. And I wanted to know what led you to that and your kind of themes about identity and personhood in the new one. What drew you to it?
You know, the way the world is changing, it's always been a thing about that I've had about, you know, the books to me, everything I write is about this change from a world that we know into a world that we don't know. You know, we're moving out of capitalism, we're moving out of paid work into a world where, you know, out of industrial, an industrial world, into all these markers that kind of defined us, like, you know, the division of labor and the division of sexes and the sort of all that kind of stuff really made us sort of, they were our sort of ways of, we identified ourselves as kind of workers working for a wage, and we identified ourselves as members of a family or a community that, you know, the communities are all being kind of raised to the ground and pulled apart, you know, under the sort of power of global capital. So we don't have these markers anymore and we're kind of cast adrift. And it's like, I mean, Trainspotting is always about what are we if we're not working, if we're not paid, mm-hmm. what's the future for humanity? How do we define ourselves, you know? And I think that the identity thing about who we are, that big existential question, if you look at the whole trans thing is a way of people addressing that. It's a way of looking at what is our humanity? Who are we as human beings? How do we best express that? How do we become the best versions of ourselves? If you look at all the confusion that's around in the world, trans people are not different from non-trans people. They may be looking at more radical solutions to this issue, but everybody's looking at, you know, this kind of thing about, well, who am I now? What am I? Who am I? How do I fit into this world? What is this world that's changing all around me? But I didn't want to make any demarcation really between the trans and non-trans characters in terms of how they were experiencing the world and how they were experiencing the confusion and upheaval in the world and how they were trying to sort of define their place in the world. I think everybody's sort of, to a greater or lesser extent, all these certainties of who we are have gone in a lot of ways. So I wanted to dive right into that rather than just mess around with it on the periphery.
The book opens with a statement about the differentiation between an adversary and an enemy. And you say, in our modern age, we're losing the distinction between the two. And I was wondering, was that also related to the kind of, because the kind of culture wars, as people put it, run through the book, but actually they're not actually central to the plot. And in some points, people use it as a distraction to talk about identity and what's going on with the thing differently. And I wondered why you chose to begin the book that way.
I think it's like, you know, we live in that social media era where everything is binary, mm-hmm. and we're divided into these tribes. And that is so interesting that the way that it actually shows how much we've been lied to for 40 years and abused by the mainstream media, because we've carried on the same kind of abusive otherworldly traits in social media that we have. All these tropes have been taken from the mainstream media to an extent. Our behaviour is very much from the mainstream media, from the tabloids, from the ranting, from the demonisation, particularly. I mean, you look at just the other week there, you've got like kind of, like Joanne Harris and you know these two women are seen as these kind of vilified people on the opposite sides of this debate, you know, and it's like and they're probably not. They're probably, you know, it's like if you talk to either of them, you'll find that, you know, that they're both kind of reasonable and sort of moderate and kind of sensible in their views and all that. And they probably would kind of share a similar kind of sort of political kind of outlook, you know. But the way that they've just been kind of made into these kind of totem poles by people who really need to belong and need to vent and need to sort of, and because of that, need to be part of a tribe, basically. And the, you know, the whole pylon of social media, it's really such a strange world to live in. And it's not a world that leads to kind of nuanced debate. And around all the issues that are affecting us now, we do need to apply some intelligence. We can't just kind of batter at things with blind prejudice.
Interesting. I'm thinking about something recently. Anthony Horowitz, he was sort of talking about this recently, and he said that he thought that writers, and actually just creative people in general, he said that they're following the cultural agenda rather than setting it in order to maintain sales as well, especially with writing. And I mean, you don't tend to shirk away from political commentary. Anyone can just look at your Twitter feed and see that. But do you think that is something that's happening, or do you think that's all a lot of hot air, or do you consciously act against the fact that, you know, your sales and your public profile could be changed based on your political opinions?
I mean, I understand kind of, you know, what you're saying to an extent, but I think that the world's moving so fast now that culture is moving so fast, and it's kind of, it's disintegrating so fast, it's changing so quickly. It's very difficult to have a zeitgeist thing. It's very difficult for any writer or novelist to say, this is the new. If writers behave like they did kind of, you know, 15, kind of 20 years ago, they would be kind of co-opted onto some sort of global think tank, you know, because now it's like everybody's chasing the economic, the financial, and the subsequent cultural changes. Everybody's trying to make sense of it. And it's very difficult to lead, you know. We've given up expecting our politicians to be leaders now. We just expect them to be kind of representatives of the 1% to a greater or lesser extent, looking after their cronies and sorting things out for them, and maybe giving us a bit of entertainment. You know, we expect our politicians to be clowns rather than sort of leaders now. And, you know, sort of idiot kind of entertainers and all that. And we, part of the whole, you know, reality TV, celebrity culture kind of schadenfreude is watching them fall and being crushed, because, you know, they only got maybe about a couple of years shelf life in them now, instead of going on for, you know, dynasty type, mm-hmm. you know, sort of second terms and all that. You know, they're there to be humiliated and shot down. We don't expect anything other than that, but things are moving too fast for anybody to have any kind of vision or leadership. Mm-hmm. As soon as you set something down, it's gone, you know. So I think that, to me, I think that is the reason that writers kind of seem to be following a kind of agenda. I mean, I think it's one of the more concerning things is the way that publishers are. You know, you're getting novels now that you see these kind of Instagram novels that are, you know, like the massive type and big borders, and you think, this 20,000 words in this. This is never a novel. This is like this is the kind of thing that I would write, sort of kind of, you know, it would be a rough set of notes before I would start to write a novel. You know, there's not the kind the discipline. There's not the sort of there's not the imagination going on. Other or against that, you have the MFA type novel, which is like the novel you just feel you've read it a million times before, and it's like it's pristine, it's well written, but it's just like you can do within the first passage, you know, first paragraph, you can tell who all the influences are. You can actually see the joy, and you think they're setting this up nicely now, but now they're going to start throwing stones at the protagonist and they'll resolve it by page such and such. It just seems incredibly formulaic and soulless. But again, that's not so much the fault of the writers. It's the way that everything's been professionalized, and it's the way that culture is assimilated now through the media and through training rather than through kind of lived experience, basically. Mm-hmm.
Do you think also it's, you know, it relates to art funding as well? And if publishers are focused on profit margins rather than creativity, and, you know, genres have to be, everyone has to be put in quite set boxes in order for things to be able to be sold, you know, every Irish writer's got compared to Sally Rooney and everything like that, you know, how do you think we're due some kind of cultural renaissance? Like, how are we going to ever get past that?
I think it's always been like that to an extent, but you know, but it's just become more so. It's become, you know, the tools have become more effective, and it's kind of way of it's very conservative, and it's a way of fleecing the public. It's very retail driven. Mm. You know, when I started writing, for example, there was like fiction and non-fiction. Basically, that was it. You know, you had two sections in a bookstore, and now you actually physically write into a genre hole. You know, you're actually writing into this slot on a bookshelf, and it feels like a kind of exercise in marketing. And but it has always been there. I remember when I first went to Hollywood after the success of the Trainspotting movie. Everybody wanted to put me on a picture deal to do scripts for studios. And I remember, like, one guy said to me, you got to give us an extra Trainspotting. And I thought when he meant give us an extra Trainspotting, he meant give us something really original and different, you know?
Yeah.
And I wrote this kind of script that was kind of sci-fi script, and I thought it was really good. And he went, this is not the next Trainspotting. And what they meant was literally give us Trainspotting 2. Give us something, get the same actors back in straight away and have a sort of, you know, they can have different adventures, you know, and on drugs or not on drugs or on something, you know. And I thought, this is nothing would depress me more to do that, you know. At the time, I just couldn't be arsed with anything like that. And I think, well, that's interesting, but that was the first time I've run against that phenomenon, you know. It's that time that we want more and more and more and more of the same until the public eventually get fed up, you know. And every time the technology changes, you have the same Spider-Man remade. You don't even, you know, there's a million Spider-Man comics Marvel produced. But you're only seeing the first three, basically, just kind of done and then packaged with other kind of cross-fertilization with other kind of superheroes and all that. So that's, you know, it's the way the entertainment kind of industry machine works. And publishing used to be a bit more kind of hoity-toity and highbrow. You know, we're a bit better than that. We're kind of beyond all that kind of crassness. And now we're kind of very much at the forefront of it, like, you know. And you get the occasional maverick that kind of maybe breaks through and something and manages to convince some streaming platform to do something that's kind of interesting or whatever. But by and large, it's the same that's kind of knocked out with a little bit of a different spin on it. I mean, I've been working on a show just now, and the first thing they produce, you know, it's like quite a big, not the crime one, but this other one that we work on. And the first thing the producers said, like, who are the main characters? How old are they? What sex are they? Where do they come from? And all that. So they're wanting just basically, they're casting it first in their own mind. You know, they want this kind of pretty, kind of box office friendly sort of people that tick boxes right across a kind of an ethnic range, an age range, a social class, perceived social class range, a kind of, you know, all this sort of stuff, which again is fair enough, but you feel that you can't, this is like it's a social engineering kind of media construct. I'm not really writing from any kind of place of any sort of cultural integrity.
It's interesting that you say that, because to turn it back on you, you do keep returning to Trainspotting, and you did eventually make Trainspotting 2. And I hear you're actually still in ongoing email exchanges with Danny Boyle about Trainspotting 3, and you've made a musical that you've told me you've
already written. It doesn't count as franchising if it's for me, though.
It's more artistic, of course. But is it because you just enjoy returning back to the old characters and you're quite attached to them, or do you actually begrudge the fact that, you know, you're making new art, but you're always going to be connected with Trainspotting?
Yeah, I mean, I've resisted doing the musical for years and years, and because Paul McIntyre was on it for ages to do the musical, and he wanted to license the tracks from the film, like, you know. And I thought, well, when I did succumb, I thought the only condition I would do it in is if I could write my own songs. I don't want to license the songs, because I hate all these musicals that they just bung in songs to kind of, they're not really musicals, they're stage plays, you know. Mm-hmm. Evan Hansen is one, it's a great stage play, it's a brilliant play, but they just bunged in these crap songs to make it into a musical, which it never is, like, you know. So I wanted the songs to really say something about the themes, about the characters, and about telling the story. So that was, you know, so we wrote, myself and Steve, my music partner, we wrote all these different songs for it, and fortunately, they really liked them, so we've kind of worked out all these tunes, and we're quite up for it now, you know, and we're very happy with it. But it was like that thing, I thought, well, if I don't write this musical, I'm a pile of ashes in an urn on somebody's mantelpiece, some other from was going to come along and say, let's, you know, we're doing the Trainspot musical, the cryogenically frozen Andrew Lloyd Webber is going to come along and write the Trainspot musical, so that, you know, I'll take the loot myself, thank you very much, if you please. There's also the challenge of it as well. You think to yourself, wouldn't it be great to do something as a musical that's actually darker than the book and the film and the stage play, you know? So that's one of the driving reasons as well. The challenge of doing something that's going to engage a lot of different people and pull a lot of people into this whole thing is to reboot it for a whole different time as well. You know, we've written new characters into it as well. You know, so I think to do something that's the same doesn't have any kind of interest or challenge to me. I think you take something like that and you make it into something else. I think that's the thrill of it to me.
Well, it's great that you have the creative control, as you say, not letting someone else do it for you. But I also wondered, looking back on it and returning to it, is there anything that you actually wouldn't do now, or you change, or you think won't resonate with new audiences?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, you know, you basically want to, when you're writing, the most important thing you can do is amuse yourself. Like, you know, if you're not having a good time and enjoying it, nobody else is going to enjoy it, you know. So I think that if you look at, you know, there's a lot of the, you know, like the old key Trainspotting scenes, if you like, you know, that they kind of, the people want to see them and they work and there's a familiarity. But there's other ones around there you can think, well, let's do something more interesting than happened previously. You know, let's try and beat that, you know, make it so, make these characters that we know much more of now, we know them better. Let's kind of see different ways to can pull on their swords and all that sort of stuff, you know. So
I mean, you're right in that it's become iconic. I noticed that story about someone finding a toilet in Brazil and saying it was exactly like the one in Trainspotting. And it must be fun to have made cultural shorthand that everyone can enjoy, but it also means that you've gone from the kind of enfant terrible of, you know, fiction and you know, doing crazy stuff to being this like celebrated and quite acceptable part of Scottish culture. And does that ever annoy you, or do you kind of?
I hate this kind of sort of almost like this national treasure type thing.
Yeah.
You know, I try to kind of say, look, I'm still a fucking bad like, fuck, like, you know, but nobody takes it seriously. They just laugh at me.
I'm still a raver.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like, it's one of the things I've got a novella coming out next year that I've done with John King and Alan Warner as part of For Seal Club. And because it's like, John's publishing it through his London Books imprint as an independent, small independent, I've kind of taken the opportunity to go really nuts on it and kind of go do something really twisted and mad and dark with all these kind of up young kids during COVID, basically, like, you know. Yeah. So I think it's kind of I still think I'm going to get this kind of reaction. The reaction I always strive for, people going, oh, he's gone too far this time, like, you know. So I still kind of strive for that kind of reaction as well.
Yeah, I see that. And I wanted to talk to you because going back to the new book as well, I mean, especially in Filth, you're clearly inspired by Alistair Gray with the kind of typography and filth and the experimentations. But I wondered, do you ever try and temper things being too excessive or, you know, being too reactionary? Or how do you do it in a way that you don't feel like you're writing something that's gratuitous and it actually adds to the plot as well? Or do you just actually enjoy writing something that's provocative?
I think you have to, it has to come from character. You know, that's always my kind of standard measurement. If you just write something for the sake of shocking, then you don't, you know, it's like, I mean, that's, you know, if you think about James Bond, you know, you have all these kind of James Bond characters, like, you know, he's got a first in Oriental languages at Cambridge, but he's also an expert in jujitsu and karate, and he's up on the streets, and and he's hard drinking as well, and all that, you know, and he's also a great womanizer, you know, and you think, this is nonsense, like, you know, it's a kind of wank boys kind of wish fulfillment kind of thing, you know, and you have to kind of, you know, you don't have, you can't have a kind of an accountant, kind of happily married kind of accountant who suddenly goes out and decimates everybody in the streets in a kind of kung fu war, basically. Mm-hmm. You have to have the behaviour have to match the character. I like to make the characters extreme. I like to make them having a really bad day, basically. I like to get two people having a bad day in different ways and stick them in the same room. And that's where you get the drama. You don't really get drama. You don't get drama in fiction when things are going right and everybody's making the right decisions. You get drama where everybody's up because they're not doing the right things, you know, they're in a bad, you know, it's like somebody's come home and found their partner having sex with their best friend, and in that position, what you do, you know, you don't really, you know, you make the wrong decision, you know, you either kind of set about them with a baseball bat and end up in prison for the rest of your life, or you go to the pub and you destroy yourself with alcohol, and you take loads of drugs and you go out and you get into all sorts of mad adventures and sort of you make life worse for yourself by the decisions you make. You know, you don't do that when you just go home and you're deciding what to watch on TV. You know what I mean? There's nothing, you know, it's like there is no drama there. There's nothing, you know. So I like to amp up the drama. I like to put people who are maybe a bit kind of who maybe a bit having quite uncompromising ways of dealing with things anyway, but put them in the position so that the drama's kind of amped up. I really enjoy kind of doing that, and it's I feel it's like how you get over that is that you always have to show them kind of somehow, you have to show the consequences of everything they do for them and for other people around them. So nobody gets a free pass. So if anybody does something beyond the pale, they pay the consequences for that, and you show them paying the consequences. You show the anguish and the suffering and the tears that come from that kind of behaviour, both for them personally and for the people around them, which kind of, you know, sort of impacts further their kind of pain as well, you know. So it's like you can't, you know, and but the other thing you have to do, the second thing I think as a writer, you always have to have them, even if they're stumbling around in the darkness, you've always got to be groping for that light switch. You know, you've got to, an audience will stay with somebody no matter how dark they are, if they're kind of trying to be good, if they've got some sort of idea that if they, you know, if they're trying to find some way, some kind of consciousness, some kind of epiphany, or they're trying to find some exit, or they've got some kind of plan to get themselves out of the mess that they're in, even if it's robbing a bank or something like that, or, you know, it's like, you know, people want to see people that are f***ed up try to get better.
Yeah, interesting, because, you know, you write a lot about people with a lot of trauma or self-destructive habits as well, but something which you, like Lennox, for example, as your protagonist, one thing he isn't is apathetic, but then a lot of the people that surround him are. He's very engaged in justice, and a lot of what's going on in your books is about corruption and people letting people get away with things, and so you've got this protagonist that's really searching for it. But I also noticed in the book there's a lot of corruption that mirrors what's happened in the past few years, and I kind of wondered, was any of it uncanny predictions, or is it all inspired by things? For example, there's a bit all about for people who haven't read it yet, there's a Tory MP who's trying to give a former colleague a contract with the NHS for his pharmaceutical product in the hope of getting promoted to health secretary. And I wondered if any of these are, is that you just...
Well, you don't have to look too far for corruption. You
know? Yeah.
Too far for kind of abuse. But another kind of, you know, it's like, and it's... You know, anything that a writer can write and imagine is always is happening. This is back to the point that was made earlier. You know, it's probably happening somewhere. It's, you know, we're no longer. I don't think, you know, I think that circumstances and technology and all that are leading us into a place, and we're no longer in charge of that. You know, we're no longer We are catching up with culture, as has been said, but I think it's for these reasons that, you know, the technology and the politics and all that, and the finances are just moving so quickly away from, you know, from how we've understood things to operate.
But do you think that people still have the capacity to be shocked and outraged by incompetence and corruption, or like disgusting things, or anything? Or do you think that, you know, we've been so overexposed that we are either apathetic or actually just it's all...
I think we realise that the whole thing is kind of is unsustainable and is crashing around us. And I think most people are kind of... I think most people in a way... I'm quite optimistic. I think most people are kind of closet anarchists, but they don't really think that we can get involved in a revolution that involves us designing a new world. I think, you know, people think, well, let's just let this mess fall apart and then we'll sort it out and then we'll deal with it in some ways. Eh?
Well, I also, I read an interview where you said that you're actually quite a jolly person, but you find that lots of stuff just goes out on the page. Is that still true?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange because I always feel quite upbeat and quite positive, and, you know, I think I'm probably known as quite a sort of it's quite a happy-go-lucky kind of jovial character around family and friends and all that. And then I always get a bit of a shock myself when I look and I see what I've written. You know, I think if I don't get that feeling, I'm quite worried. You know, it's like if I don't get that fear, you know, like my old mum, she's 93 now, and I've always got to have this thing. My mum's going to read this, like, you know. So I keep telling her, you've got to keep living, because if I lose that kind of fear of your disapproval, you know, it's going to kind of send me into a bad place, basically.
Well, it's funny you say you're happy-go-lucky, because amongst all the very dark themes and some quite graphic scenes in the book as well, there's always a lot of comedy as well as social commentary. And so does that all come very naturally?
Well, I think it's like, part of it is, is natural, because it's like there's a very, in Scotland, there's just a very kind of, tradition of black humour and cultural black humour. People kind of, people laugh at the most kind of darkest and horrendous things. But I think it's like, the laughter is born, a lot of the best laughter is born in darkness. And I think as a result of that, the contrived element of it for me is that if you're writing something that's very tense and you're asking people to stick with kind of quite unbearable material, you have to have the respite of a laugh now and then, because laughter isn't so much, it's not always about just finding something funny. It's a mechanism for reducing tension. So if you give people the chance to laugh at something, then they'll kind of go with it, and they'll take a little time out, turn the page, and they'll go, ah, great, I'm relaxed now, and then I can just sit back and I'll just look and go into this. And it's not so threatening, the thing they've been reading about.
But I also know that while you're famous for your kind of very many lives, from wild youth to working as a councilman and everything, you also spent quite a large portion of the 90s winding up journalists by telling them fictionalized versions of your own life experiences, which I quite enjoyed. But I wondered, is that an intentional mystery about yourself, or was that all just for a laugh? Or
for a laugh, and also I think because I find myself quite boring, it's become funny because there's two documentaries that have been made about me now. I think kind of one is much more than enough, there's two. And one of them's been following me around for a year. And it's been quite liberating for me in a lot of ways, because they've been following me around to all these different places that I kind of just go from work and to write and to meet people and to hook up with friends. And it's like, and it's the interesting thing about it is that I've been thinking me, I'm more interested than I thought I was. I'm actually doing quite cool things and all that. But because you go around in your own head, you don't really think of yourself as being interesting. You kind of think that, you look at somebody and say, that person there, they've got an interesting life. They do this, they do that. That's quite interesting. And you don't really put yourself in that kind of place. But when you look at it abstractly, you think, yeah, I do actually have quite an interesting life, But you also think I'm coming across as a bit of this documentary. You can see it in the rushes, and you think, God, they've got to let me into the edit and all that. And then you think, well, no, because maybe I am a bit of a probably am. I think everybody is to an extent. I think I am. So just, go with it, enjoy it, embrace it.
You are right that you've got loads going on. We're talking just beforehand because you've got your own record label, and I know that you're still DJing and everything. And I was thinking about your interest in music when I was reading the book as well, because you write a lot in vernacular, which I assumed was your also interest in rhythm and music. And how much do you think about that when you're writing? Are you just very musical? Is it always with you?
Well, I think I've always got my decks and my kind of my keyboard is kind of always next to my computer there, and I'm usually sort of I'm usually working on stuff simultaneously. I'm kind of getting ideas for music and songs together. And then I think, well, this is an interesting, the mood that this is putting me in is inspiring me to write something, And then I write something, I'll find a character or a theme or a scene. And then I think, well, this is kind of quite interesting. There's maybe start messing around with the keyboards again and get a kind of moody feel to it, And that's it, I always thought that, with acetone, so I was kind of going out and I was kind of raving and coming back, and my head was just pounding with all this, not with the drugs, I suppose, as well, but also with the dance, with the kind of effects, and the beat was just smashing away and still throbbing, my whole body's just kind of throbbing with that beat. And I thought, well, I want to get that pulse, that constant movement in the book, and the vernacular was a way of doing that, that performative kind of sort of speech was very much like the 4/4 beat for me. And all the stuff in the big clubs, when they started coming out, the light shows and stuff, and the video installations and all that. And these were like the effects on top of the beat for me in a lot of ways, So that's why the typography and experiments came from as well, to make it look. So it was kind of like, messing around with all that stuff, and it's all driven by music, basically.
Is it also a point of pride, though, writing in Scots at all?
No, it isn't really. I mean, it's like I've never really. It just felt the best way to do it. It felt the most, you know, the characters came to me in that way, so it seemed pretentious not to. I was never into, you know, into the same political kind of, I suppose Jim Kellen would be the sort of best example, that, you know, who's seen it. This is an act of claiming our culture and claiming our, you know. To me, I always just felt that we had it, you know, we can just, people should just do it if they fancy doing it, like, you know. And it was, to me, it just seemed to be the best way to tell the story, the way that the characters, the way I wanted to tell the story of these characters, it seemed to be the best way. If I was, you know, if I was getting somebody to tell my story, or you know, the story of people around, my friends and family and all that, I wouldn't have them speaking in a kind of RP. Basically, it would seem a bit ridiculous to do that, you know.
Yeah.
So why should it be like that in print face?
It's interesting that you brought up Jim Kellen, though, because I know. You know, obviously he won the Booker Prize, and at the time that was such a big deal and a kind of point of contention. But do you think now that that's not really an issue in the literary world anymore?
I think it is, in a way. I think because you know, I think that if you look at what happens, it's like with the Booker Prize is very much a way for people to become huge writers, huge established kind of sort of writers, and feted by the whole festival circuit and the literary establishment, and writing for the posh papers and articles in the New Yorker and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at kind of working class British writers that have kind of, you know, sort of from traditional working class backgrounds, I can think of like Jim Kelman and Graham Swift, and you know, it's like the Booker Prize didn't actually seem to do these guys much good, you know. Mm-hmm. If you had a kind of colonial background, it was more exciting to the liberal guilt of the kind of white British bourgeoisie, but not really kind of traditional proles. They didn't seem to kind of cut it in the mix, basically.
Are you quite glad then that Trainspotting didn't actually get listed in the end? Then
I'm delighted. I think it would have been a sort of kind of co-opting kind of thing for me. I almost feel that I'm better in the. I've always been the kind of the bad boy at the back of the class, not the super-me bastard at the front of the class. Like, I just feel more comfortable in that position. Like, yeah.
And it's funny you call yourself the bad boy at the back of the class, because I heard you described once as the bard of big night outs as well, which is sort of...
Oh, sounds good. I like that.
Liked it as well. I was like, that's a nice one. But it's, you know, fame enables you to be able to experiment and get published and try new things as well. But obviously it eventually is always going to separate you from where you came from and the people that you're writing about at the beginning. Or do you think personally that's never going to be an issue for you and you're always going to be connected to your roots and to working class culture and to everything?
I think no. I mean, I don't think I am. I mean, I think that, you know, it's like you do change. You move around. I think that a lot of people, not just myself, not just writers and artists and all that, we are in the spotlight. But I think that carpenters, sort of plumbers, and so a lot of my mates who've sort of who've done well and all that, you know, you can see that they've moved into a sort of into a different kind of social milieu to some extent, you know, even though they hold on to their kind of roots and they hold on to who they are, the essence of who they, because the essence of who you are is always formed in your childhood, teens and early adulthood, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that determines what kind of writer you are, what kind of person you are, and all that sort of stuff. And I've never tried too hard to move away from that. It's never really been an issue for me. But I think that you do have different opportunities, and you do meet different people, and you do get into different scenarios, and they affect you in different ways. And it's pointless kind of trying to pretend that that's not the case. You know, you really have to go where the music takes you, basically. And you can't. And I love transformation. I love changing. I love kind of doing different things. I love sort of. You don't want to look the same and dress the same and act the same and live in the same place and travel at the same places and go to the same pubs. Some people love doing that. I can't. I've just got to mix it up. I've always been like that since I was a kid. I've always wanted to go to different places and see different things.
I'm going to come on to audience questions in a minute, but just continuing on from that, I'd like to speak to you about what your working on at the moment? Because I can hear lots of rumors about all the cool stuff you're doing. I mean, someone read somewhere that you're doing a radio novel with Bret Easton Ellis. You know, is that all still happening?
Yeah, I mean, I'm out there next week, actually, and the week after next to LA, and we'll spend a bit of time working on it. And we're kind of winging it, really. We have a very basic idea which we've pitched and which we've signed up to do. You know, so we've been paid money now to develop it, so we have to get on with it. It's interesting. It's an interesting thing because we're talking about doing this. We've had this idea, and we're talking about doing it as a TV show. And Brett has said, like, he had this idea, well, why not do some radio? Because he got into this podcast thing. It's going to really become popular. He's really had a good experience with doing radio, and he's got some kind of knowledge about it now. I've got absolutely none, basically. So I thought, yeah, do this as a radio play, as an audio book, but cast with kind of top actors and kind of, you know, being sort of just a kind of typical blagging Scot. I thought, this is great. If we get paid for this as a radio show, we can maybe sell it on as a TV show later on, get paid for it, you know. So that was the sort of, you know, that was the rationale for doing this. But we've kind of wanted to work together for a while, and this seemed to be the right vehicle that would do it. And it would give us a bit of, I think a radio series of radio plays, it gives you a bit of freedom. You know, you don't have to sort of, you avoid that trap of like, who are we going to cast in this and have this, you know, this, we're going to cast all these kind of pretty boys and pretty girls to do all this stuff, and you know, and we're going to, you know, we're going to cast these great, crusty, old, experienced actors to do. So, but I mean, we can just get good talent. We can also you don't have to envision them kind of doing things. You just have the, you can get into the psychology of the characters and the drama of the characters. So that seemed to be a very good starting point for us with this.
Do you enjoy collaborating with people? Because, I mean, you saying that you didn't want anyone else to be able to make the musical made it sound like you kind of enjoy a level of creative control, but then also you've allowed people to put on Trainspotting and Porno at Edinburgh Fringe, and you've been very supportive of all of that. So are you quite happy sometimes to just let people
get the away from me, basically. I'll get rid of it and see what other people can do with it. You know, like if you get the right people, collaboration is fabulous, because it's like, you know, the thing is already there. It's not changing. Nobody's, you know, all this nonsense people talk about, is it true to the book? Is it true? You know, it's like, I don't need it to be true to the book. The book's true to itself. The book's there. You know, that if people want to remix something and make it into something more interesting or different, or take it off in a different direction, that's brilliant, because I don't want to see the same thing. I want to see things that are, you know, I want to see change, and I want to see things that are different and kind of, you know, in a more contemporary, or pushing the envelope out in a way that I didn't think that would be done. We've got Jenny Fagan doing writing The Blade Artist, which you know, I think that'll be fabulous, like, you know, because it's just, you know, if you've already got Robert Carlyle's going to reprise Begbie, and you've got Mad Book and all that. If you throw Jenny Fagan in the mix as well, you've got something much more interesting again, basically, you know.
So you're happy with people taking it on afterwards, but when you're writing a novel, are you fairly open to edits? I was also wondering if you used a sensitivity reader for this one in any way, and if you kind of...
Yes, yeah. I mean, we've used a sensitivity reader on Crime, which, you know, on the Long Knives, which I didn't realise that the publishers were doing that, and I was really kind of... I thought, you know, this is just some kind of censorship. Basically, I was really sort of against it, and when I saw what they'd actually written, it was just so it was brilliant. It was such a considered and sort of and warm and helpful and interesting sort of an educational for me thing that made the book better. You know, so it was a great thing to actually, because there's a lot of nonsense talked about these things as well, and I probably would have been one of the persons that would be talking the nonsense. And then you experience it, it's completely different from what people imagine it to be. But that's, I think, because we had somebody who was just really brilliant and knew what they were doing.
And someone who was sort of productive and informative.
Yeah. And did it in a kind of spirit that they want the thing to be better, basically, you know. not, you know, they weren't there just to trash, you know, they weren't there to trash it at all. They were there to make it better, to make it not just better for trans people, to make them feel more affirmed. It wasn't a question about making people feel more comfortable. It was looking at that kind of authenticity, and making the characters as psychologically believable and as authentic as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's what you strive to do as a writer. And on the TV show, there's been a sensitivity reader as well. And again, that's been a really positive experience for us so far. You know, so they've gone through the scripts, and everything is. I think the scripts actually improved as a result of the book, as a result of the sensitivity reader in the book as well. You know?
You used the word, you said that you were worried that it was going to be sort of censorship at the beginning. And I know you said before that you kind of aim for people to be like, oh God, he's really gone too far this time. But have you ever been told like that it's actually too far, or it's not adding to the plot, or have you ever been reined in?
Yeah, all the time on TV, because you just can't get away with things on TV that you can get away with in a book. You know, I mean, I can write anything in a book almost, like, you know. But that's the brilliant thing about books. You still get away with murder, basically. In the TV, you know, you can't, you've got, you know, it's like, I'll just kind of, this kind of sex scene thing in the TV, and they just, you know, you can't, and it's also the different medium, you know. You kind of, what you're doing in a book is you're working with the reader to create a film. The reader's making a film in their head, using your book as the rough material, you know? Whereas, like, if you're seeing something that's done by a writer and a director and actors and all that, you're seeing their vision of it. That's pushed into you. You've no real sort of interaction, or very limited interaction with that vision, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why people always prefer books to, you know, they all prefer the version of the book, because it's their version, basically. So I think, you know, there's certain things that you just kind of get away with, you know. And it's like, I remember, like, there was when I did a rough screenplay for the Bedroom Secrets of the Master Chefs, and I think there's a lesbian scene that goes on for about four pages or something, a lesbian love scene that goes on for about four pages, which I was typing away, kind of. And then when I kind of thought, I can't, when it came to adapting it for the screen, I thought, can't ask actors to do that, because this is real people. So I just put they made love, and then let the director do all that. Like, he or she can work all that out, like, you know.
Yeah, that seems wise as well. Well, I want to come on to some of the audience questions as well. So people keep sending them in. We've already had some funny ones, which is great to start with, which is someone says, what's the most outrageous thing you've done in the past month?
The most outrageous thing I've done, easily, I got pissed. I went out with a mate of mine's, and he got really emotional. He's been having a rough time and all that. And I got drunk with him, and I'm not used to drinking. And I fell over and I split my head open, and I got knocked myself unconscious. And I got taken to the Royal Infirmary, and my wife got called, and he's been taken away in an ambulance. And she got into the ambulance with me, and we got, you know, and I passed out and I woke up. Still drunk, kind of singing David Bowie songs with blood gushing from my head, and that's an emergency. And you know, I'm about 30 years older than everybody else in the place, like, you know. And I've had kind of concussion since, you know, it's just working itself throughout the system now slowly. So that probably is the most outrageous thing I've done in a while, and that was about a month ago.
Enjoy the fact that you're singing David Bowie songs in the back of an ambulance. That is funny.
Yeah, and on the gurney in the hospital waiting corridor.
I'm sure everyone loved you on the
walk. My manners, I thought, you know, they might, just to get rid of me, they might treat me first and get me out of there. Like, but they were really lovely. I was outrageous. It was terrible. It was outrageous.
Do you, okay, someone's asked a question which I don't think you're going to like, which is, they've just said Sunak or Truss.
Oh, it's like, I don't know, it's that thing, it's like kind of cancer or an aneurysm or something like that. You know, that kind of, what is the sort of, yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, I don't think, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it will be trust. I mean, you know, you knew as soon as it was, they're not going to have anybody brown-skinned as leader of the Conservative Party, because it automatically just smashes the Brexit coalition which is kind of fragile now anyway. But it's I think that Sunak never had a chance from the start. And it's inevitable that it will be trusted. And it's like, the interesting thing is that if there's one person in the country that's got the potential to be even more stupid, ridiculous, venal, corrupt, and incompetent than Johnson, trust is about the one person who could possibly pull it off. So we just seem to keep diving deeper and deeper and deeper into the bottom of the barrel.
And there's a lot about that in the book as well, about just people, you keep going for the same people all the time as well. So there's a lot of...
We're in an abusive relationship. The British public's in an incredibly abusive relationship with its own establishment. It has been for years and years and years. And it's actually getting worse and more pathetic.
God, that's a good headline. We've got a slightly different question now, which is going back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, art perhaps becoming more sanitized and more profit driven. Are there any young writers or young creatives that you're reading and really enjoying and you think are going to be important?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, obviously, like Jenny Fagan, I think she's brilliant. I've had her, you know, I've kind of basically signed her up to work on the Blade Arts. I said, you've got to do this, like, because you're brilliant and it'll be great, basically. Mm-hmm. Gabriel Cruz, you know, kind of London writer, I think he's just brilliant. He's going to be one of the biggest and best writers we've had here. There's a lot of great new writers, kind of young writers coming through. The big problem is that the most interesting ones aren't really part of that kind of the kind of corporate sausage machines kind of sort of stuff that we get out. And so I think we need to have a space, a kind of a really bold, underground, interesting publisher that's kind of quite well-financed, that's just taken on really interesting voices and not just kind of daft Instagram writers, basically. They're believed that they're hyped as being interesting and new and cutting edge. They're not the one.
Do you think that might ever be a project you'd take up?
No, I mean, I can't do everything. I've just been, I was down at my old stomping ground, the Muir House, with the building a new big arts hub down there, and it's really interesting and fascinating and all that. Yeah. And, I've just been asked to kind of get involved and help out there, and I have to, because it's my old kind of manor and all that, you know. But I'm just spread so thin as it is now, you know, and I can't really be involved in everything. We've got the record label. We've just knocked out kind of six tracks already that have all done, they're all brilliant. They're all doing really well. But it's just to keep an eye on everything and to keep involved in everything and to give it your best, you can't really sort of do it.
Yeah, I suppose you can't have a record label and a publishing house and be writing.
Maybe I can, though. Maybe I can.
Someone's also asked something funny. They said, you write a lot of quite gritty books and TV, but do you actually enjoy any lighter material? So does Irvine Welsh have a guilty pleasure?
Yeah, I mean, karaoke is kind of my guilty pleasure. Cheesy karaoke. And I do like big kind of cheesy power ballads. I like to belt them out. And I have a sort of... My karaoke standards are like... I kind of Sheena Easton medley. I do Modern Girl 9 to 5, kind of, you know, brackets Morning Train if you're in America. For Your Eyes Only, the Bond theme, you know, so the trilogy of super Sheena Easton hits. And, I started doing that in America. So that's like, you know, but I do love a good kind of sort of cheesy karaoke. And I love good, clean, mainstream pop. We all love 80s pop and these big anthems and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I do, you know, I do have a lot of guilty pleasures. I do kind of, you know, I don't mind going high or low culturally. Like, you know, it doesn't sort of bother me. If I enjoy it, I enjoy it. It doesn't matter.
Good. You should never be a snob. I think that's the right way to be. That's actually all we've got time to talk about and quite a funny question to leave it on as well. But thank you so much for giving up your evening and talking to me. It's been a real pleasure.
No worries, Esme. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This episode of the podcast starred Irvine Welsh and was presented by Esme Bright. Esme produces this series with me, and we have help from Nicole Wong. Our editor is John Doughty. If you love literature, you'll find more of it at howtoacademy.com. Coming up in the next few weeks, we're hosting John Irving, Kate Moss, William Boyd, Camilla Shamsie, and Will Self. Till next time, I'm Vass Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.